You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
I view them as a friend. I have tremendous respect for President Xi.
Nobody wins in this war, and they're hurting different people.
So there may be a time when we have a decoupling. That's something the president will consider.
We're not going to be lifting tariffs.
I never saw any common ground between the two sides.
The U.S.-China trading relationship.
Trump himself basically thinks he's playing poker, and other parties, particularly the Chinese, are not. They're playing chess.
Hello and welcome to the U.S.-China Trade War Update with me, Finbar Birmingham, on the Political Economy Desk here at the South China Morning Post, coming at you from Times Square in the heart of Hong Kong Island. This week we are marking 2 years since the start of the trade war, when Donald Trump slapped a 25% tariff on $34 billion of Chinese goods on July 6, 2018.
So we have a lot of things happening, but in particular with China, we're going to be doing a Section 301 trade action. It could be about $60 billion.
How did we get here? Where do we go from here? I'll be joined in part two by former White House trade advisor Clark Jennings to discuss a situation that has spiraled beyond anybody's expectation. In the first part of the show, I'll be joined by political economy editors Joe Shin and John Carter to discuss our own home here in Hong Kong, national security law, and the threat of retaliatory sanctions from Washington have pulled Asia's world city into the eye of the storm. Sharp analysis on what this sweeping and game-changing law means for wider US-China relations incoming. Hold on tight. Joined in the studio by John Carter and Joe Shin, our political economy editors, and I'm going to start by reading these two gentlemen a historical document to see what sort of trigger response we get. The US Customs and Border Protection has begun collecting a 25% tariff on 818 imported Chinese products, brackets list one, valued at $34 billion. Guys, that was obviously given effect to the first round of trade war tariffs, which happened 2 years ago this week. John, where were you 734 days ago?
I was preparing to move to Hong Kong to work for the South China Morning Post.
Okay, and how do you feel about that decision now?
I love it here, especially my colleagues in the trade beat.
Great, great. Tushin, you already were firmly installed here at SCMP.
Yes, by that time I feel that this is something going to be very big. But still, it's beyond my imagination. It's getting so out of control. No one can predict this trajectory.
Yeah. I mean, it really has been. And it seems to be gathering pace, not in terms of tariffs and not in terms really of actual physical trade, but in terms of the rivalry, it seems to be snowballing with every, I was going to say every week, but it seems like we're waking up or we're getting through every day. And there's a sort of cataclysmic or a seismic event that, John, last year would have been our biggest story of the month.
No, indeed. And it's, it raises serious questions about where the bilateral relationship is going. And obviously the biggest issue with regard to that is going to be how the presidential elections in November play out.
When this thing started a couple of years ago, we based here in Hong Kong were sort of bystanders, commentating from the sidelines, still are in physical trade terms. But obviously in recent weeks and months, we've seen Hong Kong really be dragged into the eye of the storm. The national security law, which was rolled out last week, really has provoked a huge reaction from the United States. We're expecting some sort of sanctions to come. We're not sure what they'll look like, but the US government is expected to sanction some individuals, perhaps Hong Kong officials, perhaps Chinese officials, for their role in this sweeping national security law. John, this is one of the many moving parts, and I think it's tempting to sort of cover them all as different moving pieces, but they all seem to be part of one big blob that's all dragged together. Where do you see this national security law fitting in with the wider trade war and U.S.-China relations?
As we've already described, the bilateral relationship is deteriorating. And this, the national security law in Hong Kong is the latest major event in a long series of events. And if, as expected, the U.S. sanctions Hong Kong and Chinese officials for their role in the new security law, the question is how many officials will be sanctioned and what goes next. The new Hong Kong Autonomy Act, which has been passed by both the House and Senate, would mandate sanctions not only against individuals, but against banks that do business with those individuals. That would give, and now Trump hasn't signed that law yet, but is expected to do so soon. If the U.S. is going to sanction banks, and that those sanctions wouldn't come for a year, so it's not clear which president would be in implementing those sanctions.
But I think they have to come within a year. I don't think it's necessarily
It's within a year after the State Department report, which, and the State Department has 60 days to come up with their report naming the individuals, and then the administration has a year, up to a year, to impose the sanctions on the individuals and the banks. And so one of the things that the U.S. could do, and this is something of a nuclear option, is to restrict major foreign banks, including Chinese banks, from using the U.S. dollar system. And that would really wreak havoc with the banks themselves and potentially with the Chinese economy and potentially with the world economy, because China is the second largest economy in the world. You restrict some of its major actors from working on the world stage, and you don't know what the ripple effects are going to be. It could be significant.
Zhou Xin, how much of a concern do you feel like this is within China? They're obviously expecting something from the United States, but do they expect this nuclear option?
Well, I think for China, the biggest change from 2 years ago, I think 2 years ago, the mainstream idea is that the China-U.S. relationship will neither be too good nor be too bad. I think that's kind of default mode for Chinese researchers and Chinese policymakers. And 2 years later, I think this has completely changed. They say they see the U.S. is trying to contain China or to sort China's development. I think this is more of a kind of new consensus now. So China's choice will only be like at what kind of level or what kind of timing to engage in this full-fledged confrontation against the United States. And the financial sanctions, whether it will happen or not, will not change this historical trajectory for China.
But do you think that there's, you mentioned obviously that I get a sense that people are expecting the worst. I suppose that they don't expect too good, too bad. I suppose that people are bracing themselves for this nuclear option. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I think they see the risks, certainly. Mm. It's on their radar. As we can see, Guo Shuqing, you know, the China banking regulator, has been warned against, you know, the money printing by the Fed, and also particularly just China Security Regulatory Vice Chairman is warning that China could be treated as Russia in terms of financial sanction. So you can see that Beijing is seeing this risk. But as for how serious or how realistic that this is going to happen, I think this is still a low probability even for most Beijing policymakers or watchers.
Yeah.
Now, one thing to keep in mind is that Trump has opposed unilateral and mandatory sanctions since he became president. He wants flexibility. So if he is reelected president, and he were to be confronted with the need to impose sanctions, the current thinking is that he wouldn't do as much as he might. He would do perhaps not the minimum, but certainly not this nuclear option. Mm. Now, if it's Biden, we don't know, obviously. It could be he would want to remain tough on China, or perhaps he would like to de-escalate tensions. And one way to do that is not to impose mandatory sanctions.
It's just what you're picking up what you're saying there, John. Trump's track record sort of speaks for itself in this frame. He said himself that he didn't target Chinese officials with regard to Xinjiang and the persecution of Uyghur people there because he didn't want to jeopardize the phase one trade deal.
Right.
With regard to the United States relationship with Russia, as per the 1991 Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act, bit of a mouthful, this was after the Russian government was accused of poisoning a couple of people in the United Kingdom. Trump was obliged to put sanctions on Russia, but he went for what was considered the lowest ball that he could throw, which was blocking US banks from operating in Russia rather than going after Russian entities. So he left them alone, and that was considered by sanctions experts to be among the lesser options that he could have taken. So to your point, John, he has track record of not going hard. And Joe-Shin, the Chinese government has already warned Washington that they're crossing these perceived red lines, such as what they see as interfering in Hong Kong, interfering in Taiwan and so on, will put the phase one trade deal at risk. Do you think that the Chinese government is serious on that, that they will sort of torpedo this deal if Trump oversteps that mark?
Well, for the Chinese government, the phase one trade deal is the only thing possibly they can rely on to maintain this bilateral relationship from getting to a very low point. So at the moment, I don't see any point for Beijing to, you know, to give up its commitment on this phase one trade deal. On the contrary, I think China will, as China is seeing the other issues, as Hong Kong, Taiwan, and South China see, there are little limited room for compromise. So they are relying more on these kind of trade deals, you know, to maintain this relationship. On the other hand, we can also see that China has been threatening. You know, they will also launch their non-reliable entity list against the supposed U.S. companies. But so far, 1 year later, more than 1 year later after they make the threat, they haven't announced it. And one important thinking behind this is they don't want to piss off the U.S. businesses. They still want to put a friendly face to the U.S. business community. You know, China is still open for business. You know, we have no intention to usurp your leadership of the world. You know, our market is big. As long as we can sit down and have this nice talk, discussion, and, you know, you can still make money here. That's one of the things that China is relying on to manage this bilateral relationship. Because for Beijing, apparently, it's not time yet for China to have all-out confrontation against the United States.
Interestingly, Joe-Shin, on what you say there, the business community has always been considered, I think, within a very strong lobby group in the pro-China camp within the United States, obviously because they want to do business there. We saw a story in the Wall Street Journal at the beginning of the week where I think something like 40 American business groups, 400 would be a lot, 40 American business groups called on the US administration to put more pressure on China to buy more goods. So, I mean, I wonder whether we see that the tide is turning there, whether it's maybe some US businesses are ready to cut their losses, John, or do you think maybe not?
Well, I think that is part of the evolution of trade relations between China and America, that a lot of American businesses are splitting their businesses in two. If you're selling in China, then you produce in China. If you're selling outside China, then you're looking, if you haven't already, you're looking to move some of your production out of China to other countries where there aren't the political issues that are currently burdening the U.S.-China relationship. And so there is a rethink of trade and commercial relationships with China, but is by no means an abandonment of China because it is the world's largest consumer market. It is 1.4 billion consumers. Mm-hmm. That's huge. And any company that wants to make money is going to need to be in China. And you look, for instance, at Tesla, whose stock market value recently became more than Toyota, which produces 20 times more cars, more than that, largely because of their success of their new plant in Shanghai, producing and selling cars in China, because their plant in the U.S. in California had been shut down for almost 2 months because of the coronavirus.
Yeah.
It's the Chinese sales that kept Tesla going.
Yeah. And the Chinese economy has been bouncing back. Just a quick update before we wrap up about the progress towards the trade deal. Friend of the show, Chad Bowen, has been tracking US exports to China very closely. They're still quite a bit behind based on the US Census Bureau data for May. But we can also see that there are strong purchases in the fields of agriculture. So exports in May of the 548 products covered by the trade war deal were 11.5% up on May 2019 and 11% higher than May 2017, which is the baseline of the deal. So we can see that they are buying more, 468% surge in the shipments of meat from May 2017, largely due to the fact that China has opened the market to more meat products. But Zhou Xin, we also saw this week, or this month rather, maybe even last month, that China has had to, I guess, close the border to some meat imports because of coronavirus outbreaks elsewhere. So I guess what we see is everything is sort of dependent on these little pockets of coronavirus outbreaks or big pockets around the world. So everything seems a little bit fraught economically at the moment.
Yes, I think Finbar, these kind of China decided to, you know, stop importing meats from individual exporters in Europe or United States is more related to control of the coronavirus. But the real big picture is, you know, the coronavirus impact is it's dampened China's overall demand for imported goods. That's a real problem for exports in the US or in Europe. So if, you know, China's demand is very weak, for instance, China's demand for oil, for fuel, it certainly reduced a lot because the planes are grounded and, you know, people are not travel as much as before. So this will definitely affect the implementation of the phase one trade deal. At the same time, China is saying, look, you know, by market, we shouldn't import that much, but still we are willing to, you know, honor our promises. We are buying as much as we can.
Mm. And I think as long as there's a hefty load of soybeans on ships to China by November, Trump may be happy with that.
Absolutely. I mean, he needs all the help he can get at this point.
Yeah. Before we finish up, John, give us a snapshot of what's ahead in the Chinese economy next week.
Well, we have two very big pieces of data next week. First, on Tuesday, we'll have the new trade data for June. As you recall, exports rose surprisingly in April, but then fell again in May. And so the question is, in June, what will exports do? Given the sharp effect of the coronavirus in Europe and America on demand for those exports. So that will tell you something about the state of Chinese trade economy. And then on Thursday, we get GDP data for the second quarter. And this is likely to show, expected to show, a modest rebound, 1% to 2%, which by Chinese standards is very slow growth, but it is growth. And the U.S. and Europe are posting quarterly growth rates of -9%, -10%. Mm. So China is the first economy out of the coronavirus problem. They locked down their economy for 2 months, and it worked. And coronavirus cases have made a modest rebound in China, but nothing near what's going on in the United States, for instance. And so the Chinese economy is improving, led by domestic demand. And so going forward, China is going to have a lead time of at least one quarter, if not two quarters, on the rest of the world.
Zhou Xin, just to finish up, as somebody who's been covering the Chinese economy for many years, did you ever think you'd be covering a story where 1% to 2% growth in China would be hailed as a global success?
Oh, yes. I mean, given the background of the global economic slowdown, I think 1% is already a win for China. So
yes, definitely.
Yeah. Great stuff. Guys, thank you so much. We've got a great guest coming up in the next part of the show. Clark Jennings is his name, and he has an extensive CV, but the bit that you're most interested in is that he was the White House trade advisor to President Barack Obama. He's going to give us some incisive analysis on how we got to this point, but we're also going to throw it forward to the US election, the upcoming campaign, and where the US-China dynamic may feature in that. And a topic that we expect to hear discussed a lot more over the next few months: what might this situation look like under a President Joe Biden? Clark Jennings is the Managing Director for Asia at the US Government Relations and Public Policy Advisory firm C&M International. In a previous life, Clark was White House Trade Advisor under the President Obama administration. He joins us on the line from Singapore today. Clark, thanks for joining us. 2 years on from the first tariffs of the US-China trade war, can you really believe how wildly out of control things have spiraled?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Finbar, and it's great to talk today. Did we notice today the actual anniversary?
It was July 6th, so it was 3 days ago. Yeah, this week.
An auspicious week, then. We'll just leave it at that. To answer your question, I don't know that we would have thought that we would have fallen this far, is the answer. And when I look back on 2 years, I'm trying to work through the question of whether this was all worth it, and of course, where we stand and what to expect moving forward. And, to try and work through that calculus, I think of, all right, well, let's look at, what has this all gotten us so far? And I'll answer this from, more of the lens of the U.S. domestic view, since that's where I'm from. But, this is all of this, at the impetus of the Trump administration, has contributed to an incredibly volatile period in our stock market, in our U.S. domestic economy. It's added to an incredible amount of uncertainty for the business community. I also look at things like, a tangential effect, but, you saw this week, the White House has indicated its intent to withdraw from the World Health Organization in the middle of a global pandemic, which is related to U.S.-China relations. We, the United States, has been forced to commit, I think it's now over $28 billion of American taxpayer money to subsidize farmers and ranchers across the United States for the lost sales that they would have had to China. And lastly, I have yet to see any real data that shows the kind of broad realignment of supply chains or a sort of mass reshoring of production and manufacturing to the American shores that we were promised by this. And so, again, it just comes down to, was this worth it? And if there were any gains, at what cost? At what cost, not only to the U.S. domestic economy, but at what cost to our relationships around the world and our standing on the global stage?
Yeah. Those are all very valid points. But I think a lot of people would also say that people perhaps who didn't give or didn't support this trade war at the start, didn't support the tariffs, have sort of said, okay, well, you have to give President Trump some sort of credit for bringing China into line to an extent. So all those things considered, do you feel like maybe under previous administrations, the one you served included, maybe you guys could have gone a bit harder on China? Does this sort of situation tell you that?
Sure. And I think that's exactly right, Finbar. I think I'm willing to give credit where it's due to the Trump administration. I think there is a growing consensus in Washington, at least, that to your point, there needed to be a tougher stance. I don't think I will be considered blasphemous for saying that, as an Obama appointee, that the Obama administration, could be criticized for maybe not going far enough on certain points in the U.S.-China relationship. I think the Bush administration, it would be guilty, and administrations in across party lines prior to those, because there has been, I think, a bipartisan consensus going back decades, even, that the way to deal with China was to engage. I always think of, I think it was the former U.S. trade rep Bob Zoellick, who famously, opined that we want China to become a quote responsible stakeholder, to liberalize their market, come into the international order, and be a responsible stakeholder in the global system. Well, let's all admit that that's failed. That strategy has not worked. And so, I certainly, to your point, I absolutely agree. And I think there is a consensus in Washington that that strategy has not worked. And so we have to think about, okay, what is a new strategy? But the question, of course, is what is that strategy? That's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And I think people, and I share this view, I think the principle that it was time to take stronger action on China is widely agreed. But I think it's in the Trump administration's execution and in their tactics and the way about that they have gone about this that has been disastrously flawed.
Mm-hmm. What would a halfway house look like? And I know you said this is the $64,000 question. and I guess, you know, if we are where we are now, right? The United States and China, they are where they are. You might have another 4 years of President Trump. You may well have a new president in Joe Biden. I mean, which parts of the Trump policy do you think he will have to hold on to? He, I guess, can't revoke everything that Trump's done, considering that might be seen as a concession to Beijing. I mean, what do you think that some sort of a halfway house under Biden might look like?
Well, let's start big picture with foreign policy under Biden. I would say, first of all, we would try to counteract what... you know, some of the broader flaws of the Trump administration strategy, which has led us to push away our allies. Famously, on day three administration, of course, the Trump White House, you know, pulled out of TPP. And we can talk about that separately. But that, you know, kind of took away our biggest economic opportunity to strengthen our trade relationships in Asia. And he has gutted our State Department, our Foreign Service, and walked away from global institutions. So I think you certainly would see a reset to have a more engaging posture, to look to reestablish the U.S., you know, on the global stage and work with our like-minded partners. Now, to China actions specifically, I take your good point. You know, I don't think that, you know, Joe Biden would come into office and would start walking back all of the things that that Trump has done in the U.S.-China relationship. I think you may see him roll back some of the tariff actions, for example, that are purely quote unquote, you know, a Trump core policy. I certainly think, you know, questions around the revocation of visas, for example, you know, this is now getting broader than just trade, but some of these things he would look to walk back immediately. But I don't see, and this is key, I think there's become this kind of hardening of the consensus view in Washington, as we've already mentioned, that's kind of hardened around the need for action in China. And so I don't think you can walk back, for example, some of the actions potentially against Huawei, you know, and the integration in some of our ICT and tech supply chains. You know, that's just too politically divisive. So I think you're going to continue to see on that front, there's going to be some real strategic competition that, of course, it is going to continue to play out between the U.S. and China, particularly around tech, cybersecurity, you know, open internet, that's not going to change. And I think the Biden administration would continue that.
How long can Biden be sort of quiet on this? I mean, it's smart, I think. You know, a lot of people have said that it's smart for Biden to allow Trump to sort of say what he's saying and keep a low profile. But I guess sooner or later, he's going to have to come out with a China policy. He issued his strongest statement yet. Was it last week, earlier this week? Feels like a million years ago at this point. But he actually came out with some concrete criticisms of China and so on. But I'm wondering, what do you, I mean, how long can he leave it before he sort of starts revealing his hand on China?
It depends on if we have presidential debates in the fall.
Well, true.
You know, for starters, he would certainly be asked that question in at least one of them, you know, and that's a little bit up in the air, or at least a concern among people about whether we will actually have those debates. But more broadly, I think it's a topic he's not going to look to engage on, at least at the forefront. There's simply too much going on the domestic front, at home in the U.S. And then this campaign, obviously the COVID response and economic concerns, healthcare, social issues, criminal justice and racial justice. That this is, let's be honest, this is not going to be a top of mind first priority for the Biden campaign. I think there's more downside for Biden in talking about this. Now, to your point, the Trump administration is most definitely going to continue to push him on these questions. This was one of the first actions that came out in the campaign once Biden emerged from the primary. I think there's a super PAC aligned with Trump that made something like a $10 million ad buy in some key Midwest battleground states and started labeling him as Beijing Biden.
Yes.
You can still go to BeijingBiden.com right now to get your fill of that. So look, it's out there and they think it's strong footing for them. I think on the Trump side, it's obviously a comfort area for the president where he feels strong and wants to be on the attack. And I think there's just there's less to be gained for Joe Biden to be talking about this issue because he wants to be laser focused on the U.S. recovery. And there's more political potential downside there. So I think he's going to play it cautious, at least in the campaign.
Yeah. And where does Hong Kong figure in this, Clark? You know, obviously, we're waiting to see what President Trump will do with regard to the Hong Kong Autonomy Act. We're waiting to see what potential sanctions may look like. You know, Biden has come out and also been critical of China's rollout of the national security law. I guess some of these powers that are at the president's disposal are one-off powers. And the fact that there is a unified voice criticizing China on Hong Kong, do you feel like Biden is sort of in a bind there? Like he sort of has to go hard on Hong Kong? Do you think he would be as hard as Trump maybe? Or what's your sense of what that might look like?
I think what I would say there is that he may be forced into a stance there. And the reason I say that is it's not simply the Trump administration or the Trump campaign that will want to push him on that. It's that the U.S. Congress will push him on that. And his former colleagues in the Senate. This is a kind of boiling issue in the Congress, and I think a lot of the members of that body want to see action. And we've seen some action, obviously, coming out of them already, and I think that's something that's going to continue. Now, will it rise into an issue that, you know, potentially boxes in Joe Biden during the campaign? I don't know that that's the case, but it would certainly be something that if he were to win on November 3rd, that's going to be at the front of the list of issues that he's going to be forced to deal with.
Yeah. You're sat in Singapore, Clark. Is there a sense that the international community, back in 2018, there was strong outcry against tariffs, against the trade war. There was a sense that the international community was not supportive of this. Is there a sense that, as we discussed, that maybe in Washington, the criticism and the hard action on China is has more bipartisan support? Do you get that sense from the international community as well?
I think there's a recognition. I don't think it differs necessarily from that consensus in Washington. I think, and first of all, let's draw this line. There's a clear difference, I think, in the way that, you know, American multinationals and other multinational companies grapple with this question between those that are viewing the issue more broadly. So those, for example, that sit here in Singapore and look at it through a lens of, you know, how they're conducting business throughout the Asia Pacific more broadly versus those companies that are in China to be in China and truly have a, you know, substantive, substantial stake in operations and business serving the Chinese market. You know, those companies are serving China for China and they're going to be there. I don't see them pulling up stakes and leaving, you know, even amid all of this talk of reshoring and supply chain shift. I think I saw, there was some surveys by AmCham China, the American Chamber of Commerce in China, earlier this spring that said they surveyed their membership, which is large, and said, you know, how many of you are actually making moves based on this? And I think their numbers were something like only 9% have actually started relocating or shifting their sourcing. I think the EU Chamber did a similar one and it was similar numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, we're amid a global I stretch and call it an economic calamity. It's most certainly a global downturn. You know, corporate cash is tight and there's just this incredible amount of certainty, and not the least of which, Finbar, of course, is what's going to happen on November 3rd. So I think a lot of companies are sitting tight. I think they are concerned on the overall dynamics. And I certainly think there's concern about where we go from here. Mm. But I think at this point, and certainly over the course of the next couple of months, and we've been talking just now about the dynamics of the campaign, I think it's probably prudent to wait and see what happens on November 3rd.
Yeah. And just to round up, Clark, you mentioned earlier in the call that there are issues that possibly won't be rolled back, stuff like Huawei, stuff like tech, I guess, mm-hmm. a separation of technological areas. Do you see that decoupling as being inevitable? And how far do you expect that to go?
That's my biggest concern, to be honest with you. You know, I think when we talk about decoupling, I think, you know, some in Washington and certainly in the administration have kind of this very simplistic view that, you know, it's almost autarky for America, that everything should be made here, you know, by Americans for Americans. And that's simply not, I believe, a viable reality in a globalized economy, of course. What is my concern, though, is your point, is this fragmenting, particularly of the open global internet, of our communications, our tech and ICT infrastructure, the creation of the splinter net, you know, and where there is a wall and expanding the great firewall, and it becomes a wall between China and US, and everyone else has to kind of line up on either side. I can tell you, sitting in Singapore doesn't want to be forced to choose, you know, and I think other countries would answer in a similar fashion. Don't force us to choose one side or the other. But I do think this is the spot we have to pay the most attention to, because, you know, you can go straight to the, you know, China's Made in China 2025 plan and kind of map against those pillars, whether it's robotics or biotech or artificial intelligence, 5G. There is this thrust in DC that we need to start competing and drawing those lines clearly. And this is American industrial policy being formulated in front of our eyes. And so the question becomes, for elected officials, for policymakers, and for those of us that, you know, are broader stakeholders in the international community, is that the direction we want? Mm. And I think that's the most challenging question. And I think it's something that we really need to be watching, that companies need to be watching, because it's going to draw kind of, that's going to be the battle lines for the future.
We will check in on this throughout the next few months. Clark, we'll be keen to talk to you again before and after the election, of course, to see how things change and see where the world is. But that's been brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today, and we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. I look forward to it. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's US-China Trade War podcast. I have been Finbar Birmingham on the Political Economy Desk here at the SCMP. Don't forget to keep up with scmp.com for all news on US-China, national security law, Hong Kong, and follow us on Twitter at SCMP Economy. I'm at F Birmingham. That's Birmingham with a B-E-R, not like the city. Keep washing your hands, keep your social distance, and we will see you again, same place, next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.